Well, welcome everybody. I think there are probably still some people who will be trickling in, but I'm going to go ahead and declare a quorum and get us started. Welcome to the final university colloquium of fall semester. I'm looking forward to today's talk. I've been looking forward to it for a while because it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. We invited Howard Zaire to give a talk on whatever he had going these days, and then he pulled Mark Sawin in as well, so you're getting a twofer today. Howard probably is familiar to many of you, but let me say a little bit about what he means to us. He got his PhD at Rutgers University in 1974 in focusing on social history, European history. But he's better known around the world for helping to create and define the field of restorative justice. So we can call him a field shaper, if not a field inventor. And in addition to his important teaching and scholarship that he's done here at EMU, he's been an important public ambassador for us, particularly around issues of justice and restorative justice. In fact, I just saw an email today that noted that at a meeting in the White House this week, they passed his latest book about children of incarcerated people around the table so that everybody could take a look at it and see it. It's a photo essay book about the children of people in prison, and the group was meeting to talk about children of people in prison and what to do about them. So Howard is influential across a wide range of fields and is helping not only to shape the field of restorative justice, but also to carry EMU's mission into the world. And in recognition of that, just recently the academic cabinet bestowed on him the rare honor at EMU of the title of Distinguished Professor of Restorative Justice. And in the coming years, he'll be spending, I think, even more of his time in that kind of public intellectual work that extends our mission into the world in important ways, and we're all grateful for that. Mark Sawin is also, I think, well known to many of you, teaches in our history department, is a professor of history. He did his doctoral work at the University of Texas at Austin in American Studies, and he's an expert in American history and also American popular culture, and I'm guessing that's why Howard pulled him into this project as well. His most recent book is called Raising Cain, and it's about an explorer in Antarctica named Cain, and I'm forgetting the Cain's first name, but Elisha. Got to get the prophet right. So I don't know exactly how they have the presentation planned, but I'm going to turn it over to Howard to begin, and welcome.
Well, thanks, Fred, and thanks to the rest of you for coming out. I've been looking forward to this because the chance to pull this project together and tell some of these stories for the first time. As Fred said, I enjoy doing photography and interviewing as a way of sort of connecting people, people who don't have a visibility, don't have a voice. And so I've done books on life sentence prisoners and victims of crime and children's prisoners. Some of you might remember this book that MCC did, we used to call it a dry roof, a cow on a roof, but it's really a dry roof on a cow. And Nancy will know who this is on the front. But it was a book about our partners around the world, and I was in charge of it and did some of the photography. But after a number of years ago, Merle Good, who's one of my publishers, in a meeting, he sort of, you know, you never quite know. Merle comes up with some pretty wild ideas sometimes, but he says, when are you going to do a book about pickup trucks? And I thought, I thought he was kidding. But last summer, a year ago, I was ready for a change, and so I went to Good's with this idea of this people in Virginia in their pickup trucks, and wouldn't you know it, they not only jumped on it, but they scheduled for publication this coming Father's Day. Father's Day is the second biggest book buying year, day of the year. I didn't know that, but you know, no one knows what to get fathers, I guess. It beats a necktie. So I really had to get going on it. So I had to figure out and started figuring out how do I access truck owners and the networks of truck owners and all of that, and I around the state, and I had a lot of fun doing that. And I've done 65 or 70, and I've got more than I can use, and I can hardly quit. My favorite image, though, is Mark is, there's around town, there's a woman driving a black pickup with pink trim. And he has been trying to stop her. He runs around waving his hands, and she thinks he's a stalker, and she's avoiding him. And we still haven't gotten her. So anyway, before this is done, I'm hoping we'll get it. Well, this is the draft. This isn't necessarily what the cover will look like, but it's the latest draft of what the cover will be. It's called Pickups, a Love Story. And today I'm just going to share some of these stories and trucks with you. This is a little what it might look like. This is the first draft layout. This is a Diamond T truck. Bob Badgett has this truck. It was called the Cadillac of trucks. This one was made in 1948, but it was used often during the World War I and World War II. And a lot of the parts for these things you can get around the world, but you can't get in the U.S. because they were just left after the war. And Bob likes to take this around town to shows and just talk to people. A lot of the people with vintage trucks just like the chance to talk to people. So, but he said the Diamond T that comes from the fellow who started this, Mr. Tilt. His father was a successful shoemaker in Chicago, and that was the name of his company, a diamond and had a T in the center, and so that's the emblem on here. So the book will have kind of details of the trucks and various things. This is Gerald Young. Gerald said about 10 years ago, I just decided I wanted a hot rod truck to enjoy myself, to think I'm a teenager again. I'm just in a world of my own, enjoying myself. I'm a diabetic. My blood sugar was down, and when I get in this truck, it all goes away. He says it's about going back to our childhood. He said he got it up to 110 one time, but now he keeps it at 40 or 50. He says he's too old to get speeding tickets. So this is called a street rod, but this is a rat rod. And I've had the chance now to connect with a lot of rat rod builders and drivers, and they're a lot of fun. This is Buck. Buck says, the gas pedal came off one of my wife's sewing machines. She'd kill me if she found out I was robbing parts from that to build this truck. The hood over the transmission is from a Craftsman lawnmower. He said, I had a piece of 1950 truck for 25 years. I wasn't going to work on it until I had a door, and then a friend gave him a door. He had to saw down a big tree that had grown up in the middle of it. It's a Camaro front part. Then I tied on a channel flat tubing. It's got a Chevy steering box and a Ford power steering pump. Differential came out of a 1970 Nova. The grill, that's 79 Ford. My motor is 39 Ford pickup. It's a 61 Cadillac tail lights and so forth. That's what rat rods are. You have trouble registering because you don't know what year they are. He said, the beer cooler, he said, you know, as a kid, we used to carry beer around, but now I figured I ought to have it right under my seat. He says, I'm just a car nut, been all my life. Told my wife, she's dead now, poor thing, cancer. Told her when I met her, if you don't like cars, you don't like me, because I'm a car nut. She hung with me. She'd get in the garage and help me pull transmissions out and everything. But when she got older, she'd say, when the blankety blank you going to grow up and quit messing with them blankety blank cars? I said, what the blankety blank did I tell you? In 57, I ain't never going to grow up. If you're a nut, you're a nut. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, this is another whole family of rat rod builders I had a lot of fun with. The father and the daughter and son, and then the barn, the building behind Connie, the woman there, married a rat rod builder. So they all rat rod builders. Connie says she's an interior decorator, and so it's all decorated. And she says it's a girly truck, but it's got a big engine. But on the other end, now here's Kobe Dean. Kobe's 19. He had another beat up truck, and he had just had this one about 2 weeks when I met him. He said that truck, that same body style, that was in Kip Moore's music video, Something About a Truck. If you haven't heard that, I hadn't known about this song, but Mark came to me one day and said he'd just been in the hairdresser, and all the women at the hairdresser have this song on his phone. So I had to look it up, and sure enough, that truck inspired Kobe to get this truck. He says, I said, my truck to express myself, a statement, to be honest with you, to rub in everybody's faces. When I was in high school, there were ones that didn't think I could make it, didn't think I would be anybody. Just feels good driving around and seeing all the people I went to high school with, the ones that doubted me. He says, around these areas, we love our trucks. I mean, you have not experienced anything until you hop in a truck and drive through the mountains with no idea where you're going. Your grasp of nature, it's the best feeling in the world. He looked at my Jeep, and he rolled his eyes, and he said, a vehicle goes off-road like a Jeep. If it doesn't have a bed, it doesn't make any sense. What happens if you need to help someone move? What happens if I want to take a girl out for a ride, and we want to stargaze, and if you don't have a bed to lay in? A truck is everything you want. He had a little cultural comment to make. He said, James Madison folks wonder why we love trucks so much. You can take that truck right now and drive right through JMU. Not a single person will look at it. No matter how loud it is, they won't look. City slickers. You take it to Bridgewater College now, people are dropping their jaws all over the place. Now, Tommy Starks, I loved Tommy Starks. Tommy is a brick mason, a real character. The guy, the contractor that told me about Tommy, said that, you know, he'd contract him to build a stone wall, and in the middle of the night, something would be going on. He'd look out the window, and Tommy's pulled his car up, and he's using his headlights, and he's building the wall, you know, because it needed to be done. Tommy said, you got everything. People used to say, you got everything except the kitchen sink. I finally put one up there. Now they look and say, oh, you got the kitchen sink. He says, on jobs, people say, homeowners say, how in the world do you find things in that truck? I can find it. They call it a Tommy load. He lives on a farm where his family's been for 100 years. There's so many sub-stories in here I could tell if I had time. Chris and Jeannie, this truck they've had it as long as their relationship, and it symbolizes their relationship. They were migrant. They worked at farm, and they traveled around, and they got this truck from a friend who had rolled it, you can tell. And they've had it ever since, and they say it symbolizes their relationship. Jeannie says, obviously it's not aesthetic pleasing to most people. We've been pulled over by border guards, harassed by cops. At the Canadian border, they took everything out, even checked the panels. Our truck just sends out this vibe of drug dealer, mass arms dealer. And Chris says, I think that's the Hollywood version. I think real people that smuggle drugs look a lot less suspicious than we do. Yeah. You can hear some close-ups of it. Jeannie says, a little bit of, blankety-blank to all that glitzy TV show style. You don't have to have a brand new car. We don't have a payment. We don't have people hounding us when we lost our job. And that allows us to do some pretty cool things in our life. Chris says it's a little engine, the little engine that could kind of thing. Chris says, it symbolizes more of a specific time in our relationship. And it's a really solid foundation for what we did during that time. But it's also about what's possible. I would say that it symbolizes is just the possibility to do whatever we want, that we have the opportunity to do for ourselves if we want to. Chris told a story. He said, we had to replace the windshield. I was talking to the guy. He hadn't seen the truck yet. And he said, you could get black or you could get chrome around the windshield. And I'm like, black's fine. We don't need chrome. He's like, you might want the chrome. It's only a couple bucks more. I'm like, no, wait till you see the truck. You'll understand. He says, all right, let me do this. I'll get both of them, and when you see them, you can decide. And as soon as we pulled up, he's like, you just need the black. I was like, yep. Chris said, I love the truck. I understand why some people might not like the truck. Now, George and Kathy met 25 years ago, and one of their first dates was in an old pickup truck taking it to a load to the dump. So Kathy figures she knew if he was going to take her on that date and she's tolerated, it must be okay. This is a late 1931 pickup, one of the first to ever have fully metal enclosure for the cab. Usually they had cloth hanging down. But the interesting story about this, George bought this 50 years ago when he was an in high schools or college students from a kid that had taken it all apart and it was all in bushel baskets. And George says he wasn't a very good college student, and so instead of studying, he'd go out and he'd work on his truck. And he gets it all together and so forth. And then he had a business, and one of his vendors forced him into bankruptcy. And the assessors were coming, and he did not want them to know he had this pickup truck, so he took it all apart again, back into bushel baskets. And finally painted it up and put it together. They like to tour in this, and they like to take their grandkids' ice cream. And you know, they're not supposed to have kids in the back. And the way to the ice cream place goes past the sheriff's house. But the sheriff's been in trouble with the law recently himself, so they figure they've got the upper hand. Here's a couple details. It's just a beautiful, beautiful truck. Now, April Dahl is into truck pulls. And I don't know if you've been to truck pulls. These are, her class is a street mod, a 6,200-pound street mod. So it's been modified from a, but it's nothing like a real, you can't drive these things on the street. The rear brakes are the rear springs are disabled. It's got a lot of weight on the front. The engines are souped up big time. Her father got into this as a way of keeping her out of trouble as she was growing up. And now they spend, in the summer, they'll have like 25 truck pulls. I mean, they're just constantly on the road doing these truck pulls. And a year ago, she met her boyfriend, Andrew, who also has a truck. His truck is called the Virginia Redneck, and they compete together. So I get updates from April on Facebook. She lets me know she beat him out with his last race. His engine blew up. Of course, the engines blew up. One summer, he blew up three engines. In one summer, he would have a truck pull. He blew the engine up. He goes home. He borrows an engine from a friend. He works till 4 o'clock in the morning. Goes to sleep. Goes to work. Goes to the next truck pull. It's quite an interesting subculture. Michelle and David have this truck. They got it. It's a 1978. Michelle says, when we'd gotten engaged, his mom took me aside and said, I hope you're not marrying him for his money, because dairy farmers don't make a lot of money. I looked at her and I said, no, ma'am, I'm marrying him for his pickup truck. Michelle says, the first time I drove it, we had gone out, and he was heading to take me back home because I was still living with my parents, and he was in the rescue squad and got called out. He throws me the keys to the truck, and he says, take it over to your mom and dad's, and I'll pick it up. Well, it's pitch black dark, and I couldn't get it out of grandma gear. I crept my way to mom and dad's, and I pull in the drive, and my dad was waiting up. My dad looks at me, and he says, oh, my. And I said, what? He says, that boy must be in love. He let you drive his precious pickup truck? The only reason is a man would let a female drive his pickup truck is love. They have cataloged. They work on it together. I mean, on one of their anniversaries, they put new shocks on it together and this kind of thing. Apparently makes all the rest of the men in the neighborhood get all envious because their wives won't do that with them. They can tell me the story of every bump and dent in that truck. Michelle says he's had that truck longer than I've been with him, so when he starts talking about getting rid of that truck, I'm going to get nervous. And a P.S., Michelle is the chapter secretary for the local Antique Trucks Historical Society. She says, in 1997, I got up, I went to the restroom, I came back, and they looked at me and they said, congratulations, you're the chapter secretary. So I've been the chapter secretary since 97, but I don't go to the bathroom anymore. We had to have some hunters, and Robert and Mia are bear hunters, and they have, what'd they tell me, seven dogs, something like that? And the dogs just love to get in this truck. But the interesting thing I learned from this is that when they go bear hunting, most of the time they don't even take guns. It's the fun of finding, tracing, and treeing the bear, and if they have guns, they can't chase the bear onto private property. But if they don't have guns, they can follow it onto private property. So but that was something I didn't know. Art Carter is part of Coming to the Table, so you might have seen him around here in the past. He lives out on the Eastern Shore. He's a retired doctor, medical doctor, and then later went into has helped to start a nonprofit that works at poverty and that kind of thing. he said he had some, let me read this story, it's a little longer, but he said, I had my Dodge pickup and I decided instead of vacations that my wife and I had been going on with our children, I would suggest to her that we do something different. I said to her, honey, I'd really like to drive out to the Dakotas and camp out on the prairie with my bird dog Ty and hunt, and we eat off what I'm able to harvest during a day, and I'd like you to go with me. She reminds me that the first thought in her mind was, oh my God, this man has lost his mind. And then she thought, here he is in the medical practice, and God knows I've seen so little of him day and night. Here's a chance to spend some time with him, the two of us. So I'll go. And that's when we started the journey. I had my gun rack, shotgun on the rack, and dog and wife in the front seat next to me. Some local Eastern Shore wine and a bag of frozen, locally picked Eastern Shore strawberries, and we headed out from our house, heading down the road on our way to drive across country to spend some very precious time in the Dakotas. They didn't get very far with the dog in the front seat between them, though. It was slobbering all over everything, so that the dog got moved to the back. And they did that. They camped on the Mississippi. He had a DVD player and Miles Davis on the DVD player, and he opened the local Eastern Shore wine, brought out the strawberries, and that was our first night in the Dakotas. He also has a theory about different trucks that I won't take time to read here, but his on Eastern Shore, people are so interrelated, the Native American, the African American, and the white community, that they all interrelated, and he has been really active in making those connections, and you see his bumper sticker, making peace one cousin at a time. Dave Burton runs a shop, a kayak and water sports shop on the Eastern Shore, and he has this beat up old pickup. I went to a coffee shop in Cape Charles and was sitting there, and I asked the guy, the barista, who would know about pickup trucks. He said, well, there's a guy here that he knows everybody, and you need to talk to him. And he's back up there. He's talking to somebody, so don't bother him right now. Well, I sat there for an hour and drank coffee, and he starts out the door, and I went out and caught him. And sure enough, I ended up hanging around and made a lot of contacts through Dave. But he's got this beat-up truck that he will not get rid of. The engine had blown up shortly before I got there, but he still is going to fix it up. He says, I think if you park 10 vehicles in a line and pull me and 9 other people together, you would know that I belong with that vehicle. It's dirty, it's beat up, it's got a bunch of beach toys in it, and that's sort of me. He says, people will call me and say, man, I saw someone else driving your truck. What's going on? It's not even like I'm worried that someone stole your truck. It's, man, seeing someone else in your truck is really weird. It's like seeing someone else out with the dinner with your girlfriend. One of those contacts was Brooke Rogers. Brooke is a marine biologist and scientific diver, but on the shore there, you have to be a jack of all trades. Her back of her business cards, I don't even know some of these words, but scientific diving, sewing and embroidery, experimental design and construction, small boat operation, beer brewing, cheese making, sailing, scrimshaw, taxidermy, stained glass, turtle husbandry, data management and analysis, basic plumbing, Mesocosm setup and operation, YSI and CTD, I don't know what that is, driving PAM fluorometry, pink bike repair, gardening, drawing, stonemasonry, problem solving, design, and intervention. The day I met her, she was building a wall. She got this truck, which she says is a classic waterman's truck on the shore, but it didn't have any transmission in, and she bartends, that isn't on her list, but she bartends at the American Legion. So she's made lots of contacts, and so she met a guy there who said, well, I know this guy's got a truck, no transmission, and you can help me put it in. So she learned to do this. She put it in. And she says she loves doing that. She says, being a girl helps with all that kind of stuff because I'm pretty good at being grossly incompetent at things. I'm actually a very competent person, but I don't mind being a total beginner and saying I'm really interested in this, but I don't know anything, like what's a carburetor. I don't mind being ignorant because that's the only way you're going to get knowledgeable about stuff. She says, if you drop the ego thing, you can learn a lot. And you get into situations where people are like, well, you know, I got 10 different types of guns and assault rifles. Ever shot them? Like, no, but I'd love to shoot an assault rifle. Yeah, you can have all kinds of wild experiences on the shore if you're willing to be interested in anything. Now, Will is a pilot. flies 747s and 757s and so forth, and then gets into this pickup truck with no power, wind, anything. The truck was bought by my dad in York, Pennsylvania. He was a salesman and a preacher. He had a little, you'd call it a boombox, I guess, and tapes from Moody Bible Institute. So he had this little boombox and his tapes, and he'd be driving around and listening to Moody Bible Institute sermons. Then my sister and her husband got it. He was a doctor on a Native American reservation in South Dakota, so it went there. Then it went to Arizona for work with Native Americans down there. Then I got it. Now, part of the story is that my neighbor had given me a bright yellow kayak, a two-person kayak, and my sister was going to Alaska, and they decided they wouldn't take a truck there, but they could use a kayak. So I traded the kayak. But the funny thing is, somehow I ended up with both the kayak and the truck, and although they still have the oars. And it's a family tradition. It's even in a quilt here that they did, and if we have time, we can get Will to talk about this. It was started out brown, and he's not sure why it's called Skippy, but he thinks it's because of Skippy peanut butter. But it was looking pretty grungy, and they were living in California, and he decided it needed to be painted. So one day he got 12 cans of blue spray paint and went up in the forest, and when nobody was looking, he sprayed this thing blue. He says, part of the attraction of the truck is it's very simple. It's very slow. It's an extreme contrast to what I do normally. I'm certainly not going to push any buttons in here to make anything happen. There's no autopilot. You're winding down the window, shifting. Everything's manual. I like to do mechanical work, and I think that's part of the contrast with my job, where I really can't do much. To be able to come home and work on it, I think, is an enjoyable contrast to getting in a big airplane and flying 500 miles an hour. Get into that truck and drive 55. And that might be pushing it. And then he says, and that's my history, as I recall it. Now, here's somebody else you know. Lois's husband, Ward, built this camper. And at first, they didn't have a truck for it. So here's what it looked like originally. And they called, because that the Pontiac looked so sad, they called it Eeyore. And the camper was Tigger. And eventually they got a truck for it, and then it gets a lot of attention when they camp. But Ward was in the hospital on dialysis, and it had started to leak at the top, and so Lois got up on top and took the top off and got her sister to get it down, and they fixed the leak, and she and her sister still take it camping. Some of you have may have seen this truck around, parked out here. Lewis is a graduate of EMU. He says, it's my first vehicle ever. It's a personal expression for me. Just the fact that I'm in this country, I always dream big, so I always wanted to have a big truck. Never had a car in my life, neither did my family. I was born in Honduras, so I wanted to have a big truck as a way to express myself. He says it causes a lot of conversation, and I enjoy these conversations. It's part of my personality. When someone says, nice truck, that gives me an opportunity to have a conversation. He says, I get some reactions, too, that are not very appropriate, hand gestures, from people who don't like it. If you don't like it, it's your problem. I don't drive my truck for you to like it. It's a free country. These are some, I'm including some local ones here for you. This is Ron Copeland. You all know Ron. Ron says, I have this policy that anyone in the world can drive the truck if they have a driver's license and they're not drunk. I don't know how it happened. It was based on the Sermon on the Mount, I guess, just to let people have what they want if they need it. He's got some wonderful stories about how things have come back, good things have come back because of this policy. People say to me now, hey, Ron, is the community truck available, the hippie truck? It's kind of like out of the consciousness that it's really my truck. It sort of just exists. I leave the key in all the time. It's been stolen a few times. It definitely feels like an extension of my personality. I mean, it feels like it looks like me. It's blue. It's sort of beat up looking. I don't know. I can't explain it. But everybody, let everybody use the truck. It seems that that's what makes it safe or something. It just reminds me of that commitment to the Sermon on the Mount, not to use cliche language, but it has been such a blessing to people. I've seen it as a projection of myself, but the truck is beyond me. It somehow belongs to everybody. It's really cute. Some people think it's ugly, some who don't know the whole story of it, but I think it's adorable. And then, of course, a monster truck. Brandon is 24, he has all ever since he was one and a half, he has wanted a monster truck. And so a year ago, the family scraped the money. They went to 10 banks before they got anybody to finance it, and they got this monster truck. And then they had to get a semi-truck to carry it, and then they had to take driving lessons and get licensed to drive a semi-truck. But they go to these monster jams, and he seems to be a natural. He had one practice in a junkyard, and now he races and wins, beats some of his heroes like Bigfoot. You know, they jump. This thing weighs 10,000 pounds, turns crank 1,700 horsepower, if you can believe it. And if you go to Walmart, there is one of the Hot Wheels monster truck series is their truck. There it is. Bad News Travels Fast is the name of it. A couple more stories yet. Shannon Pollock is a former student of mine. She bought this class on eBay when she was taking negotiation class in our program, and she was supposed to have some negotiation experience. So she bought this thing, had it shipped in from Ohio. The driver said, I hope you know what you're getting, because this thing won't run. And sure enough, they had to push it off the truck. She wanted it partly so she could learn how to work on things. So she looked under hood, and here the battery connection come off. So she was feeling really good. Her first diagnosis had worked. She had always wanted to butcher a roadkill deer. And last year when I hit one this year too, but that's a whole nother story. Right after I did that, she contacted me, and here what happened. She was riding her motorcycle past UVA. She's in law school there, and the truck in front of her hits a deer. And so she stops and asks the campus police who are right there, can I have this deer? And they're like, what are you talking about? But anyway, they let her have it, and so she acted like she knew what she was doing. She gutted the deer and so forth by the road there, and then she rode her bike home and got her old diesel pickup truck, and she loaded it in the back, and she got halfway home up over Afton Mountain, and it broke down. So she called Wayne, the good old boy next door, and he came, and they got it home, and they put a rope on the tree, and she had to kind of hug the deer while he pulled this thing up, and they started gutting it. And then she said, I realized there was a law school fundraising ball that I was supposed to go to that night. We got the skin off the deer, and it got like thoroughly gutted and cleaned, but we ended up letting it hang overnight because I had to go wash up and turn into a lady. The next morning, we finished butchering it. She says, I don't even know what my stereotype would be at this point. I don't know if I'm more law school or redneck or what. Being a girl driving a truck feels really cool. I feel like people see my piece of shit truck coming down the road, and I'm assuming they have assumptions about who I'm going to be. I pull up, and a young girl goes to law school, and it's just not who you'd expect to be driving a truck. I get a kick out of that. And I especially like to drive into the law school parking lot with all those BMWs in my hand-me-down and my broken truck. And I wish I had lots of Richard Randolph and I met his brother and his nephew, and they have been telling me stories. They were truckers all their life, and they've been telling me stories about navigating the color line in Virginia. He wanted a small truck after driving all those big trucks. Like one time he drove his shiny Mack truck. He had clearance from the White House to drive in there, and one time he knew Gorbachev really loved Mack trucks, and sure enough, Gorbachev, the guy with a map on his forehead, Richard says, is standing on the front porch of the White House and waving, giving him the high sign. He's so excited about Richard's truck. But in 1956, the firemen in Leesburg tried to open up a whites-only swimming pool. And he was working at a horse farm. He loads his truck full of horse manure. And during the middle of the night, he backs it through the chain link fence and shovels it all into the swimming pool. And they never opened the swimming pool. They just filled it up and made a ball diamond out of it. If we have time later, I'll tell you about his mother. That's a whole story, too. And Randy and I really hit it off. He's given me when I'm in Richmond, I have a place to stay. But his grandfather was a dealer in Idaho, and his grandfather's brother wanted his truck. And so they ordered it, and he has the original calendar. He doesn't have his anniversary or anything in it, but it has a day in 1949 he's supposed to go get this truck. So they get this truck, and it's been in their family. And now he said, I appreciate your coming because what it's made me do this morning, I didn't know where some of the stuff was. I lost the shop I was in, but I went through, I found letters, and he begins to recall how this was his connection with his father and his grandfather. They negotiated, they talked together about how to restore it and so forth. And it really symbolizes that relationship. He said, it's an important piece of family history, and everybody in the family knows I have it, and they always ask about it. He said, I hit some hard times, man, and I thought I needed to sell it one time. I took it down to the drag strip to a Super Chevy event. I had made up a real nice sign and everything. I was going to sell it. My daughter had just moved here, and I was the only one taking care of her. She has cerebral palsy. I was like, man, I don't have any money, so I'm going to sell it. And I took it down there, but I got there before it opened up, and guys had all these drag cars and stuff on their trailers, and here I am with this little pickup. They asked, man, what's the story with that truck? And after they heard the story, they said, man, you can't sell that truck. What's wrong with you? So these strangers, I'm like, they're right. I can't sell this truck. So I toyed with the idea a few times, but I'm grateful that I have it. Sometimes, as with anything, though, there is a burden to ownership. He says every time he gets into it, it feels like his grandfather's riding with him. And here's some details. It's a lovely, lovely truck. Finally, Rich Bryan. Rich says, I never thought I'd be in competition with my Ford pickup truck, but the more I thought of the more similarities I came up with. We're both old and retired. I'm 75, and my truck is a 1995 F-150, old in truck years. I'm a bricklayer and used it right good carrying loads on construction sites. Each of us has a lot of miles on us. My truck has 436,000 miles on it, and I've been married over 50 years. We both could use a tune-up and some repair. We both did get some new parts. We both had our rear ends worked on. That pickup is part of me, I guess. I got a little chair out the shed, and I go out there, and I sit, and I keep the truck company. We keep each other company now. Neither of us ready to give up, but I can see the end coming. Which of us is going first? Right now, it's a dead heat. So, those are some stories, a few of the stories from the truck. Now, Mark is going to give us a little bit more academic authenticity by putting this into historical and cultural context.
Well, I was thrilled when Howard asked me to work on this project. I mean, how often do you get to drive around with Howard and go visit people and their pickup trucks? So I had a really good time doing this, and it caused me to think a lot about pickups. And when I started to do research, I was shocked and actually horrified to find that there's not a good academic book on the importance of the pickup truck in America. I don't think I'm going to be the person to write that book, but somebody should. So I started to trace its history a bit, and it's been fun research. Whoop, there we go. We get the term pickup from this vehicle. Ford, Chevy, Chrysler, Dodge all released civilian versions of their war trucks right after World War I. And then Ford in 1925 released something that they called the Model T Runabout with Pickup Body. It was $281. And this truck sold very well, and other companies started picking up on this idea. Now, this was a very rural vehicle designed for a rural time. At this time period, as you can see there, in 1920, just over 1% of American roads, and there were 3 million miles of roads, were paved. So vehicles had to be pretty rugged. And 6.5 million farms were in America at that time. Basically, half of all Americans were farmers. And so this vehicle was really designed for them. It was a vehicle designed for farm labor. Oh, I wanted to show that picture here, call attention to it. Look, this is the road from Washington to Richmond in 1919. Here it is in its improved state in 1920, where they just put gravel down. And there was a big movement to pave things back then, and it slowly picked up. Now, so given that, these, you can see by the data here, that really the amount of sort of folks urban to rural doesn't change that much between 1920 and the end of World War II. But after World War II, people started moving into the cities at a much, much higher rate, becoming more suburban and urban, and the amount of rural population sharply declined to this time. So that by the 1970s, over 4 million farms had disappeared, and the number of people working in agriculture had dropped by two-thirds. Well, the pickup truck is designed for those very rural people. So you would think truck sales would have dropped. But check this out. This is from the Wall Street Journal this month, November 2012. Look at the top five best-selling vehicles in America right now. The Ford F-Series, the Chevrolet Silverado, and the Dodge Ram PU means pickup. Three of the top five selling vehicles in the country are pickups. So what's going on? This is what I tried to start to pull out. And I apologize to all science people in the audience at this point because I don't know what I'm doing here. But here we go. Statistics. I pulled the stats. Here are U.S. auto sales over the last, from 1950 to the present, with a trend line. And I didn't know which trend line to pick on the Excel, so I picked the one that looked coolest. Here is truck sales in the same time period. Here is the amount of people that the Census Bureau says are working in farm labor. So why are truck sales going up as everybody who needs trucks is declining? Seems interesting to me. And so this is what I've started to sort of pursue. Looking at truck stats here, to put this in perspective, hold on, I need to read this right. Pickup truck sales have boomed. 12 million pickups sold in the 1960s, 29 million in the 70s, 40 million in the 1980s, 64 million in the 1990s, and 86 million in the 2000s. To put this into perspective, since 2000, from 2000 till 2000, end of 2011, U.S. manufacturers produced enough pickup trucks for one out of every four Americans, one for every family in America. We love pickup trucks. This is baffling to a lot of people, and especially foreign people. And I learned that as I started to read foreign accounts of what people think about trucks, and they were really pretty funny. One Dutch immigrant who was writing in a car blog was writing to his friends back in the Netherlands and said, explaining what a pickup truck is. He said, a pickup truck is basically a larger version of a car that comes with a bouncy ride, less comforts, uses considerably more gas, and is harder to park. Because of this, every real American family has one. Now, trying to figure out why trucks sold, I looked at advertising, and here's Chevy trucks. And you can see that Chevy has always played to people's different sentiments about trucks and what's important about a truck, what would be good about a truck, or sometimes versions of trucks. I love this El Camino. And this is even more fun, the 1961 Corvair pickup. Ralph Nader got rid of those two, I suppose. The Love trucks that came out were interesting because this is a truck clearly designed not to do truck work. It's a quarter ton pickup truck. It really doesn't, it's a car chassis. It's not a pickup, but it looks like a pickup and it acts like a pickup, and so it is a pickup. And people, they sold very, very well. And lately, though, pickups have been getting bigger and bigger again and emphasizing sort of this rural power sort of idea. But at the same time, being family vehicles, they've added king cabs and extended cabs, and so you can now stick four or six or eight people into your pickup truck, depending on the one you buy, without having them sit in the back where I used to always like to sit, but it's illegal now. So going back to this, I was trying to figure out why in the world, what was going on, what was changing, and so I looked at this time period. Right between 1978 and 1980, the number of farmers and the number of pickup truck sales coincided. Truck sales have continued to climb since then. You'll notice that U.S. auto sales leveled off and started declining after this point. And so I was trying to figure out what was going on there. And so what was happening right about this time period? And so here are my theories. Let's look at the era of 1978 to 1980 in American pop culture. This is when Dolly Parton becomes big. This is a Japanese magazine called Country and Western, with Dolly on the cover in 1979. Willie Nelson stops being sort of just a country star and crosses over into popular music as well and starts being covered on the radio heavily. John Denver's albums start being big crossover hits. He portrays himself as country, but really becomes sort of a pop star. Barbara Mandrell comes out with the song, I Was Country When Country Wasn't Cool, and starts to push these ideas. One of the five largest grossing films of 1980 was Urban Cowboy. Note that its tagline is Hard Hat Days and Honky Tonk Nights. Sort of this cowboy image in the urban environment. One of the other big films of the year was Coal Miner's Daughter, also very much sort of country themed. And Kenny Rogers comes out with The Gambler, which becomes not only a major hit in the music world, it becomes a television show and a movie. It's very, very popular. So my theory here is that when Americans farmed, they were largely dependent on themselves. Their success was built on their own hard work, ingenuity, ability to get things done. At least this is the perception. The ideal American farmer is representative of the American ideal itself. Farmers are people that plant their own crops, build their own buildings, raise their own food, fix their own equipment, and succeed or fail because of the might of their arm, the sweat of their brow, or the cleverness of their mind. They are real Americans, the kind that settled the frontier, tamed the wild west, surrounded their houses with pickup fences, baked apple pies, and didn't owe anything to anyone. This rural ideal is gone. American lifestyle just isn't the same as the rural environment of these times, but the attitude is still there. It's also true that most Americans today don't want to trade their new homes and 8-to-5 jobs for the hard work and long hours of rural life. However, that doesn't mean that Americans don't still idealize that up-by-the-bootstraps country style of life. And it's interesting when you talk to people, and there's something independent about a truck that makes you more powerful, more independent, something that a car just can't give you. When I looked at the ads from 1980 right here, these ideas of sort of country life and ruggedness were certainly very much part of the ads. This was also when the foreign truck market starts to boom, and they were advertised very differently, which I found really interesting. The Subaru Brat is especially lovely. Looking at trucks now, truck ads and such, I spent a long time trying to find a truck ad targeted toward women. Incidentally, you don't want to Google trucks and women. And if you add pickup into that, it gets worse. The ads are all incredibly masculine and really acknowledging that you are suburban, but you want to look manly. You want to look manly, right? Great mileage without ordering the engine off the kiddie menu. Or redefining playing in the sandbox. This is an F-350. This thing can pull a semi-trailer. But, you know, that's sort of the point. Never back down. And did you watch the Super Bowl and the apocalypse commercial where the Chevy trucks survive the apocalypse but the Ford ones don't? And, of course, the most masculine of all new truck things, truck nuts, which, if that doesn't say your truck is male, I don't know what does. Now, something about a truck is interesting because it sort of portrays this truck lifestyle as a country lifestyle. Again, looking for sort of women in trucks, I couldn't find any ads targeted toward women, but I could find things that women have sort of made for themselves to sort of emphasize that the trucks are theirs. What I think is most important, though, about Howard's book and what's fascinating about it is, though I think these trends are true and I like what I've found, I don't think they really pertain that much to most of these stories. People like trucks because they like their trucks, and every love story is different. And that's what makes this book fascinating to me. It's about a whole bunch of different people who love their trucks for a vast array of reasons, who use their trucks in many, many different ways, but everybody loves their truck. I don't think you ever found anybody who had a truck and said, oh, I don't really like it. I don't know. So that's all I've got. Thanks.
Stay up here. Sure. So we have a few minutes for comments or questions or... And by the way, Debbie Snyder, they sell probably more pickups than anybody around. She says that women are even more committed to their trucks than men. So I don't know where the ads are, but. By the way, I understand you can get mud in an aerosol can. If you've got one of those trucks and you live in the suburbs, you can get mud in the aerosol can to spray it on.
Yeah.
For either one of you, but maybe Mark more so. Any correlation with the women's movements, women's liberation, and the machismo shift in how trucks are marketed?
Well, you would think then that they would be marketed toward women a bit. Well, or do you think that this is men keeping their masculine identity by driving trucks?
Yeah, some loss of what is male.
Right.
Some disorientation, so we're going to find it in our truck.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's that's a reasonable thing to think. It's one of those things that's hard to measure, hard to figure out. Howard, you should talk about the story. I mean, the women who had trucks often associated their truck with some sort of independence marking event in their life. Weren't there a few of
those? That's true. There were some of them that the truck marked some kind of, one truck marked a separation, but when she separated from her husband, it was the line was the truck's gone, but I mean, the husband's gone, but the truck's still here.
Yeah.
yeah, there was a number of those. There were people who got them and then could drive wherever they wanted to drive and so forth. Yeah, that's something to that.
You know, it occurs to me that the recent popular Carrie Underwood song, keys her boyfriend's truck and carves her name in the seat and slashes all the tires because he's cheating on her. I guess to assault one's manhood is to assault one's truck. yeah, there's maybe something to that. Yeah.
You often see the typical redneck pickup with the Confederate flag and the rifle across the back and so on. In your, you know, finding stories, would this kind of a person be in a majority or a minority here in Virginia?
I think it's probably, you know, it may be our stereotype, it's probably the minority. I mean, there are, actually, I didn't find very many trucks with everybody always says the rifle rack in the back. I found almost no trucks with rifle racks in the back, even out in the country here. It's not a representative sample. I mean, this has been kind of random how I made these contacts. There would be some like that, but I don't think that's the majority of trucks actually, and truck owners here. I mean, meeting the people, this has been such fun to learn to know these people. And I can go to cruise inns and places like that, and now I know people. You know, I go to Richmond, and I go up and I know people there, and that's been a lot of the fun of this.
I don't know who this is a question for, but the connection mark that you drew with kind of the decline of the rural lifestyle and the rise of the truck was interesting and I think appropriate, but what I kept wondering as you went through it was the question between America's wars and the truck. So you started off with the first trucks were modeled on World War I trucks, and at the end you have this spike in the 2000s, which is at least partly connected to the Humvee. And then I wonder if you thought anything about World War II, and then so is there any connection of an idealization, not just of the rural lifestyle, but also of military violence?
I looked into that a little bit, and what I found articles on actually had less to do with trucks and more to do with Howard's vehicle. The Jeep seems to be very tied, and I think the Hummer fits more into that category, something that was clearly a military vehicle. But yeah, I don't know. yeah.
I mean, clearly World War I and World War II affected the development of the trucks, because a lot of those trucks were developed originally for that use, but I don't know after that.
Right.
It's an interesting question.
And Vietnam wasn't a big truck war, and that's what I was looking at for the big rise of trucks, so it doesn't quite fit there.
It seems to me that I've always associated it with class in America, with the upper, I mean, the sense of classlessness, but it isn't true that we don't have classes. And I was thinking of Sharon Pollock, for instance, but that's just, she's stating something. I think there's a lot of sense of, I'm doing this in spite of the fact that I'm not one of the upper class. I think it has to do with class.
Yeah, I think there's that.
What
dimension.
Did Marshall say about his truck?
Yeah, Marshall Yoder, he was in the ones that were flipping through. Marshall's kind of embarrassed that the truck he got looks like a lawyer's truck. He did not want it to look like a lawyer's truck. But one of the things he likes about it, he apparently was a company truck, and it had Bluetooth. And so if you go to, it had the phone numbers all programmed in, and they're still there. And so if you go through it, there's Jimbo, and then there's one called Girlfriend. And he really wants to call and find out who his girlfriend is, but he hasn't. There was a, yes.
I guess this is a question or a statement, but it does seem, I'd be interested in whether you have any comments on why among, of all the American pop culture that has gone all over the world, everywhere, from my experience, it doesn't appear that the truck has. We just had some friends here from France who know Dolly Parton, love Dolly Parton's music, and one of the first things they said was, we want to see a pickup truck, because they really don't really know it.
But you really don't see them.
No, pickup trucks sell really well here and in our neighbors. In Canada, in Mexico, there's a lot of pickup truck sales. In Australia, there's a lot of pickup truck sales. No place else in the world. When we were in Croatia, I don't remember, you know, traveling all through Eastern Europe and through very rural areas that are entirely farm-based economies and such, no pickups. That's probably got something to do with it, but these farm guys are driving old, beat-up other vehicles that are burning lots of gas, why not pickups? I don't know.
One of the guys in my here couldn't be bothered with an F-150, so he went to Switzerland and got a Swiss Army carrier, and he brought that back, and that's what he drives around for his pickup.
Howard, yeah. I was most just drawn in by the guy you got to know who sat by his pickup truck.
Yeah.
And it seemed to really have a relationship.
Yeah.
I wondered if you tended to notice that very many of the trucks were named, or if there's sort of an anthropomorphism that took place with the truck. Just what you tended to pick up on that aspect.
Well, some were named. My impression is that there were more likely women that named them than men, but I haven't gone through and counted it. I did often ask people whether they were named. But there is a very personal, I mean, in a lot of cases, people would admit to a personal relationship. One of my interesting challenges, you know, I've spent many years interviewing, but I've always interviewed people in some kind of trauma. And one of the things I found out, I didn't know how to interview somebody about a pickup truck. I had to kind of relearn interviewing. And so trying to get at that question, I tried different ways to get at this question of how do you, you know, what's your relationship with the truck? Sometimes I was successful and sometimes I wasn't. But I think a lot of people would describe a fairly, you know, it'd be like Eric Beck, whose picture you saw there for a minute. I mean, he and Susan were talking about, and she says, well, you haven't really bonded with this truck. And he says, yeah, it's not quite the truck he wants. He's not bonded with this truck. But he had with his previous truck, you know. So,
There was the one guy we interviewed who, his big white truck, he had named something very manly, but his kids called it the White Lady or something like that. And he was upset.
Yeah. Kelly was related to, he was a nephew of Richard Randolph, who was telling me these stories about navigating the color line. He's got this great, he's got three trucks, about this big white truck. And his, to his embarrassment, I think the kids call it the big white lady.
Is there one more comment? I could probably go on for a long time, but it is almost 5 o'clock.
Just to throw out two other hot sociological issues, gender and race. Talk about anthropomorphizing trucks. If some cars seem to be like men think of them as women, but what do they think about their pickup trucks? Is there a more male vibe, or like what gender is the truck for most of these people, if the males anyway? And is there some kind of going from opposite sex to same sex relationship going on here or something? And the gender, you said you had one African American in there who was very bonded with his truck, but and often pickup trucks are associated with redneck has been used here in the, you know, Old South. And has that crossed across the racial? Do black African Americans buy trucks as much as white people, or have you any thoughts on that in your experience or statistically?
Well, on the naming, a number of the women said this is definitely a her. Their truck was definitely a her. But I don't have a sense of the pattern on that. And I don't have a sense of the pattern either on race. I mean, there was a lot of pickup trucks in the Africa. I mean, I have a number of other stories in Africa. Like one fellow's nickname is Goosey, and he has a Cadillac and a pickup truck, and he loves his pickup truck. I mean, he says, I'm a pickup man. You know, I'm the pickup man, you know. So I don't know if there's a difference. I would guess it's not, but I don't know that. It'd be interesting to try to figure that out. Well, I think we're out of time. There are refreshments, I believe, here, so we can be around and talk some more. Thanks for coming out. It's been a lot of fun, and thanks,
thank
Mark,
you.
For doing this with me. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Howard and Mark. This is, as I said, the last colloquium of the fall semester, so see you again in January. Happy holidays.